Okay, February 10th, 2014, calling the House Judiciary Committee to order. Welcome. And we'll take the roll. Let's see here. We got Representative Neil Foster, Representative Max Gruenberg, and Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, and myself, Chair Representative Wes Keller. And Representative Lance Pruitt is excused, and I would guess maybe we'll be joined by at least one more later here. We have a new recorder, first meeting.
Yes.
So I try to speak clearly and into the mics and make her job as easy as you can. Representative Gruenberg. Christy Blair. I was getting there with patience. Her name is Christy. In the back of the room, we've got Sam Greeley back with us. So welcome back, Sam. So today we have two bills up in front of us. One of them is HB 292, the revisers bill, and then HB 47, a bill by Representative Feige we'll be hearing from. We're starting with HB 292. So if you would come up and you can introduce yourself for the record and give us some background of what this bill is and help us understand it. We've been joined by Representative Bob Lynn, Vice Chair. And so if you would introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
My name is Lisa Kirsch. I am an assistant reviser with Legislative Legal. And I'm here today for the revisers bill, which, as you probably know, is our opportunity to correct or remove any deficiencies or any conflicts or any obsolete provisions. We have a relatively short revisers bill this year. And primarily what it does is we have some names of agencies that have changed through changes in federal law. We have several instances of the term adoptive child, which is not the standard term for a child who has been adopted. Usually you say an adoptive parent and an adopted child. So we've tried to capture all of those. We do have an additional one that, since I drafted the bill, we found yet another, so I have a proposal for an amendment to add that additional instance of adoptive child to be deleted and adoptive child to be changed to adopted child. We also have some obsolete date references and a boiler code that has changed names over the years that we need to update. And the word stimulation for stimulating an oil well, things like hydraulic fracking, things like that are stimulating production. It is entered in the statute as simulating, which was just an error, typographical error. So that's the nature of the changes. I could go by section if you would like me to do that, or if you have questions about particular sections, I could answer those.
Thank you for offering, Lisa, but this committee has done their homework, I'm sure, and there'll be some questions that'll come up. So maybe then we can go to whatever section we need to. So
okay.
Any questions for Lisa? Well, I have a couple. One, help me understand, but when we take the date out and, you know, that refers like when it's, get an example, help me out. Which one of the sections have we done that in?
Okay.
Here's section 7.
Section 5 is the first one after January 1st, 1974 is
okay. Let's just look at section 5. You're taking out the words after January 1st, 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that includes this date and the days to come. But as I read that as a, not an attorney and a lawyer, that's a valuable bit of information for me, and it often marks a trigger when that bill passed. I kind of like that being in there. And I noticed there's three or four sections. My questions are, the only places in our statute that do that? I mean, is this a comprehensive list of those that, that have a date marker like that? And have we changed them in the past? I just kind of need a little
Yes,
background.
We do routinely go back and take out on sleep dates. That is one of the things in Title I in the section that refers to this process of doing the review of the statutes and preparing a bill. One of the things they talk about is removing obsolete date references. This date had meaning when there were still people who had rights predating that date. So at this point, because 1974 is so many years ago, the likelihood of anyone having a right that came up prior to that date is very low or none at all. And so usually what we do is we wait until the date is far enough back in history, given the context it's in, you know, the nature of the section that it appears in, you know, because sometimes something might go on for 20, 30 years, but something that is not likely to go on for that long, if at a certain point the date becomes obsolete, then we will pull it out of statute. And that is something that we routinely look for.
Thank you, and I appreciate that clarification. If it were up to me, and I certainly, you wouldn't want me setting the standards for drafting, but I'd like to have it in there. And the value to me is the historical context, but, you know, that's, thanks for clarifying that for the record. Second question I have, if there's nothing else on that, is on page 2, section 3. I just, it looks like to me that the net effect here, well, it just looks to me like there's quite a, I don't know what is in between 40.25.220 and 40.25.295, and is this a substantive change? I mean, in other words, would this be applied differently now after this bill than before?
Right. We cannot make, through the revisor's bill, a substantive change. So before I put anything into the revisor's bill, we make a determination that it's not going to change the substance. The section that we're adding here, 295, is just the short title. And the short title of a article or a section that has a short title will go at the very end. And so that's why it's at 295. And this these provisions are the Public Records Act. So it's just adding the span site, these, you know, the span of numbers that we're deleting and replacing with a span that ends at 295. It includes that provision of 295, which gives the short name for the act that was put in.
Thank you for putting it on the record. I appreciate it. Last question I have is, there's a number of sections, and I didn't really count them up. You're changing from adoptive to adopted.
Right.
That does sound substantive to me. Yeah, in the English language, adoptive means something different than adopted. Yeah, that has a time-sensitive term, you know, past tense, ED, where adoptive is related to. And there's on so many sections, you know, that I haven't sorted through to say, oh yeah, I guess that doesn't make any difference at all. And I just wondered if you have any comments on that.
The determination that we made when we looked at these provisions, when you look at the definition of adoptive and adopted, it's a little like a lessor and a lessee. The adoptive parent is the person who becomes a parent by virtue of adopting a child. The child is not adopted. The child is not the one taking the action. The child is the one who is acted upon, who is adopted. And so in standard usage, those two terms are used, adoptive to refer to a parent who has gone through the process of making a choice to adopt a child. And then adopted child is the child who is subject to that process.
Just a follow-up on that, some of the changes, though, are about the adoptive child, not the adoptive parent.
Exactly.
So the reason I'm pointing it out is, couldn't that apply then to maybe a child that was in the process of being adopted, as opposed to a child that has been adopted sometime in the past? You see my question? That's why I struggle with it.
Well, I think from what I read when I read these provisions, we are referring to a child who has been adopted, not a child in process.
Okay. It's just a question I had, and I still have it, frankly. I just wonder, you know, because of the simple use of the word, you know, when we're talking about an adoptive child, yeah, it does really, you got to ask yourself, now, what in the world did the legislators mean? And again, you know, there's a lot of sections here, you know, that were changing, and so I have that concern. Am I the only one on the committee that has that concern at all? Looks like it. Okay. Any other questions for Lisa? Is there any testimony at all on this? Probably not. In the room? Nothing called in, I'm sure. Any discussion in the committee?
Do you want to entertain an amendment?
Pardon? Oh, thank you, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
Should we label this amendment number one?
Amendment number one.
Move the amendment.
Okay, and I'll object for purposes of explanation, so it's on the record and we all have copies of it in our file. Max, or Representative Greenberg?
I think it's been described.
It's the term adopted and adoptive change in another section. Mm-hmm. Right, okay. Any objections? I'll remove mine. And any more objections? Okay, so Amendment 1 passes. Okay. Any other discussion on the bill? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, would you entertain a motion?
I sure would.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill number 292-28-LS0904/C with recommendations. Do we have an effective date on this?
Yes.
An effective date is in the legislation.
And the fiscal note.
And the fiscal note.
As amended.
Oh, yes, as amended.
Okay.
It's been a whole year.
Oh, yeah, I understand. Okay. Seeing no objections, bill passes. HB 9192. Okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to call a brief and ease here while we get the next sponsor. What we have before us now is HB 47. The committee heard the bill one time last year. There's some changes assuming you've all reviewed it and everything, what we'll do here is we'll adopt a blank CS. Let's do that first.
Mr. Chair, I would move CS for House Bill number 47. That's a 28-LS0072/N. That's for House Bill, CS for House Bill number 47.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
just for the purposes of discussion, and I'm sure I'll remove my objection, I would object because I'd like to know the differences and put it on the record. So for the purpose of objection, raise the objection.
Take your words out of my mouth. What we'll do is ask Representative Feige to explain what's transpired in the last year and 10 days and the changes that have resulted and where we're at, and if the questions are the same, and just refresh our memory. So two things, if you would, in the process, explain the differences and just give us an overview. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Eric Feige, representing District 6. The major change in the CS had to do with some additional language. And let me just get the CS in front of me here. It's on the second page of the CS, where you added a subparagraph D. DEC was, and the commissioner of DEC specifically, was very concerned that the federal permitting programs for which the state has primacy could be adversely affected, the way the original language in the bill was opened up the state to the possibility of having primacy sort of administratively retracted by the federal government. We put this language in here essentially exempting those federal permitting programs that the state administers. That is, we have primacy in those programs. We specifically exempted them from this bill to make sure there was no conflict with basically no even a hint of that somehow this bill would prevent access to the courts by other parties involved in those permits. And that was the only change that we made to the bill.
Question, Representative Goomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the explanation. I would suggest to the sponsor there may be a second change as well. And if the
Representative Greenberg, this is just a presentation question time. We'll get to the.
Well, he is in the process of describing the changes. And then once we get that on the record, I'll remove my objection, the adoption of the CS.
So, if I may, please.
What you want? Okay. So for the record, you have a suggestion on the changes?
No. I'm just trying to put on the record that I think there's a second change also in the CS. I'm not objecting to that. Through the chair, Representative Feige, if the members would look at the original bill, page 1, line 11, if you would look at the original language, which would say the bond must include an amount for the payment of wages, etc. And now on page 1, line 11, simply requires the court to consider the amount of wages. This gives the court more discretion, and I think it's a good amendment, but I just wanted to put on the record with a question. Is that not also a change, sir?
Great question.
It is a change.
Okay. Those are the only two I found. And I'd just like to be sure on the record, is the sponsor or the staff aware of any possible other changes?
No, Representative Cook, we're not.
I remove my objection.
Okay.
I just wanted to put that on the record.
Okay. I have one question more. So I'll object for expanding. Just to explain, DNR is also added, right? That wasn't in there last time also, right? Am I right or wrong?
You know.
Yeah, let me take a quick look. Maybe I missed it last time.
That's part of sub D.
Is it? Yeah.
You're talking about
in section D that was added. You talked about DEC. I'm talking about page 2, line 11, the Department of Natural Resources under 2721 is in a program approved or delegated by the Office of Surface Mining, Reclamation, and Enforcement in the U.S. Department of Interior. Is that not an addition? And did you address that? And I'm just...
Actually, Mr. Chairman, line 6 through 13 on page 2.
Yes.
Is all of that is new language, and it all pertains specifically to programs, federal permitting programs that are administered by the state government.
If you'd already said that, I apologize. Thank you. Okay, I will remove my objection. So we have version N before us now. If you would go ahead and give us an overview. Oh, a question? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Adopting version N. That's where we're at. We're defining whether or not version N is in front of us. So if you have a question related to that.
I have a question relating to version N. I can keep my question until after it's adopted.
It's adopted. Or I just adopted. So I'd
okay.
Have, yeah. So well, we have version N in front of us now. But if it's okay with you, Representative Ledoux, we have Representative Feige to give us an overview. And then we'll take questions in that process, if that's okay with you. Okay.
Please, it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman. It's okay with me. Okay. Over the past several years, there have been cases where courts have issued injunctions or stays against companies engaged in the development of resource extraction and other large industrial operations that have been legally permitted. These legally permitted projects now have to endure the high costs of uncertainty and delay. Discovery phase in these types of cases can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to the state as well as the project proponents. HB 47 does not condone, quote, sloppily written or wrongfully issued permits, unquote, as has been described by some opponents of the bill. If a permittee is violating the terms of the permit, then the issuing departments of the state should step in and either get the situation rectified or temporarily stop the project until it comes into compliance. The state has laid out a rigorous science-based permitting system to allow responsible development of our resources for the benefit of all Alaskans. Public involvement and input is encouraged through an established public process. Too often, once this process has been completed and permits are issued, opponents of the project file public interest litigation seeking an injunction or a stay. Ultimately, those who feel the most immediate impacts of these injunctions are the workers and their families, because workers are laid off, both union and non-union. House Bill 47 was filed in an intent to level the playing field and put those who file these suits on notice that they too have consequences to contend with. Some people have pointed to the title of the bill, which uses the words, an act requiring a party. The requirement for security is already there, embedded in Alaska Civil Rule 65C. HB 47 parallels the requirements of Rule 65C, which states, no restraining order or preliminary injunction shall issue except upon the giving of security by the applicant in such sum as the court deems proper, for the payment of such costs and damages as may be incurred or suffered by any party who is found to have been wrongfully enjoined or restrained. HB 47 was written to work with Rule 65C, not change it. The court already has the power and authority to require a bond. Unfortunately, in most cases, they don't require it. This legislation directs the court, when considering the bond amount, to take into account costs that may be incurred and damages that may be suffered, including an amount for the payment of wages and benefits for employees, subcontractors, and contractors. It does not set a bond amount. The court continues to have full discretion and could still ultimately decide to not require a bond. In this legislation, industrial operation is defined to include a construction, energy, or timber activity, and oil, gas, and mineral exploration, development, and production. Historically, we have not seen a large number of these types of injunctions in state court for two reasons. Most lawsuits today have involved federal permits, and in talking with some lawyers about this issue, I found that many of these cases are settled out of court in an effort to avoid costs and work delays. An example of this type of court case would be there was an injunction filed on the Point McKenzie rail extension that just as they were starting to commence construction in the fall of 2012. There was a lawsuit filed in federal court which ordered a stop work order on October 1st of 2012. Later that fall, November 28th of 2012, that same federal court lifted the order. But for 2 months, almost 200 people were put out of work and unable to feed their families. Here in southeast Alaska, as fairly recently, the city and borough of Juneau permitted a cruise ship dock expansion. The Juneau Assembly last month approved the contract. It has already had a group file for a temporary restraining order to keep the city from working on the project, work that is not even scheduled to begin until 2015. And of course, you are all aware that we have fairly large projects potentially on our horizon. Effort to build an in-state gas line as well as an export line. would involve a whole series of mega projects that could potentially be affected by someone wanting to file an injunction. During the interim, we continue to work with the administration to deal with some concerns that they had with respect to the unintended consequences centering on the state primacy, i.e. those permits related to clean air, clean water, and surface coal. And I've detailed the some of the new language in version N of the CS. The new language specifically exempts those federal permit programs that the state administers. It does not, however, do anything to over 100 different state permits that the state is currently has permit authorization authority for. The bill language will still apply to those, and a list of those permits has been included in your packet. Representatives from DNR, DEC, the Alaska Court System, Department of Law, and Ledge Legal are all available for questions. We also have a number of people online to testify. With that, Mr. Chairman, are there any questions?
Thank you, Representative Feige. Before we go to questions, I just want to put on the record that Representative Mullett joined us before we started discussion on HB 47. I didn't put that on the record. Thanks. Any questions? Yeah, we had Representative Ledoux. That's right.
So, Representative Feige, what percentage of injunctions are brought in state versus federal court? I mean, are there actually that many that are brought in the state court, environmental injunctions?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. No, actually, most of the injunctions that are brought forth are brought in federal court.
And so, am I follow-up?
Follow-up.
So my understanding is this bill would have no effect on the federal courts.
That's correct.
So, that's what I'm trying to get at. I mean, actually, how many cases is this actually going to affect? I mean, I know that the feds are always shutting down projects, and I'm just trying to get a handle on how much help this bill can give projects.
Representative Feige?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. Certainly, we do not have an impact on the federal courts because that is not our arena of authority. However, the possibility exists that plaintiffs could seek injunctions under state court. It is, I guess in my estimation, would be a vulnerability that we have within the state legal structure. As I've stated, Rule 65C already requires some kind of security. The overwhelming majority of judges do not seem to be willing to require security or require people or parties to post bonds. Is that the intent of the legislature, or is that the intent of how the rule was originally created? I don't know. But I think this House Bill 47, if passed, will send a significant message to the third branch of government that the legislature would certainly encourage judges to look much more closely at requiring security bonds, especially in cases like this. Your second question as to whether or not what the numbers are in terms of total number of cases like this, there have been some, not very many. I'd have to defer to someone in the court system to give you an exact number.
Thank you.
Representative Greenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Feige and I have talked on several occasions about the bill since it came forth, and I appreciated, I'm through the chair, I appreciated the representative allowing some time to pass to give some time to come up with this CS. I just received this a few minutes ago, and I want to study it a little more. I'm not desired to hold the bill.
Representative Greenberg, I apologize. I should have stated at the beginning, I do not intend, you know, that we'll go to a vote today. I want to give time. For one thing, we all got just distributed some a memo from Legal Services, and we want to process that.
So. Oh, there's a memo from Legal Services?
Yeah, it just came through, yeah.
So. I have to take a look at that. But what I was going to... I'm sorry. Thanks, Bob. What I'd like to do, I think that the current language is a definite improvement, and I appreciate both the representative and his staff for having worked on this. I think that's very helpful. Now, I may have some language that I will want to talk to the representative about, and if we have a couple of days, I'll be able to do that. And I think that may be helpful, but I don't want to put anything on the record today until I really have my ducks in a row. And we'll just ask through the chair, Representative Feike, would you have any objection to making a copy of your remarks so I can look at them as to your intent?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, no,
I'd
be happy to provide that to you.
I'd appreciate that, and I'll make this a priority to go over with Representative Feige and his staff and Ernest or whoever anybody else wants to designate.
Okay, any other questions from the sponsor? Seeing none, we'll go to...
Well, I just want to say, thank you. Representative Feige, I appreciate this bill. It's been a long time in coming, and I think that Alaska needs to make a statement about frivolous lawsuits and things that happen in Alaska to slow down projects, and that just in make projects even that more expensive in a time when, you know, we're at a crossroads of, you know, how are we going to develop our state and you know, where we're going to draw the line on people coming in from out of state, because it's not people from Alaska that are doing this. These are NGOs from out of state that have found a beautiful, picturesque place like Alaska and use it as their biggest fundraising tool down on the lower 48, and it quite offends me that that's how we're being treated, so I really appreciate the legislation.
So not really a question, but kudos.
Comment, yeah.
Thank you, Representative Millett. Okay, and seeing no other questions, what we're going to do is go to public testimony at this time, that we have several in the room, and I believe one online, one off it, so... Thank you, and are you going to be able to stick around if there's further questions, or do you need to get back to your committee? Here's my intent: if the plan is that we have Friday left wide open for bills previously heard, and this was part of my rationale on it. So, if you would just continue, you know, look at the comments that happen. If you have to leave, you know, all your staff keep track of them, and if you would talk to Representative Greenberg and try to. You know, get it figured out where we're at, and but with that, we'll go to public testimony. Representative Greenberg, do you have a further question?
Yeah. Is your staff here?
No, she's working on another meeting, Representative Greenberg. She's in another room.
In the other room, okay. Also, is that Linda?
Yes.
Okay. Number two, somebody mentioned that there's some kind of a memorandum. I don't seem to find that memorandum in my file.
Representative Greenberg, we'll get that to you. The staff will. They were distributed on the desk here.
Oh, it's on the desk. Oh, there are two memos. Ernest, I need those. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. We were not trying to keep them from you.
No, I know.
Okay.
Maybe we are.
It's the mushroom theory, right?
I see you moved away from me.
No, she wanted to sit next to you.
So, thank you. What we're going to do is we're going to start with Nancy Mead, who's here from the courts, and then just so you know who's online, we have Maynard Tapp and Michael Jungris from the RDC.
Young Rice.
And we have Mike Prax from Fairbanks. And then, of course, like the sponsor pointed out, the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Law have somebody online if we have questions. So, Nancy, if you come up. Identify yourself for the record and begin public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I'm here to respond to any questions you might have about the bill and how things work now and how it might be implemented. I'm sorry to say I can't be here on Friday, so I'll be happy to answer anything now. To address Representative Ledoux's question through the chair, the number of cases we track of preliminary injunctions, but we don't have statistics on the number of preliminary injunctions against industrial operations because that's not a term that's used in our database yet before this bill is passed. Anecdotally, I can tell you that over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, there have been possibly two or three cases that would fall into what I think the sponsor intends to cover with this bill. And I guess I'll just say that that this is similar to existing rules, Civil Rule 65C. The courts do have the authority to set security. Many, many times the parties stipulate the amount of the security for all sorts of actions for preliminary injunction or temporary restraining orders, and it, for the most part, the judges accept those stipulations for the amount that the security will be. The security is intended to cover the costs and damages that the enjoined party might suffer if the injunction were wrongfully granted. And so that court holds that security, and at the end of the case, if the enjoined party shouldn't have been enjoined, basically wins in the end, the security can be used to pay the costs and damages that that party suffered as part of the time that they were enjoined. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am slowly going through my file here. There are a series of legal memos in here, and I would just ask that before we return, that you get a hold of Representative Feige's office, and my own staff needs to do this too, and anybody else who's interested, to make sure that we all have copies of all the memoranda. And because my questions, I would like to reserve my questions until I know you've had a chance to review those legal memoranda. And I won't ask the court system to provide a legal opinion, but I think it's important from our jurisdictional point of view, our work on the committee, that we carefully understand the language of Rule 65. Because only then can we understand the legal issue involved here, which is what, if anything, the courts will be changed by this bill. And my questions now are preliminary, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mead, just generally, the court has broad discretion in issuing injunctions, does it not? A trial court.
It has discretion whether or not to grant a motion for a preliminary injunction, but there are specific legal tests that it needs to apply.
No, I understand.
Representative Grunberg?
I understand. And if you feel comfortable through the chair, could you briefly, unless we're going to have some other lawyer here to do this, do you feel comfortable in enumerating what those factors are, or do you not feel comfortable?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I would probably misstate them because I don't have them written in front of me. I guess I'd defer until I can study up on it a little bit.
Because of the fact that we've already said that we will be hearing this on Friday, Nancy, if you come prepared to put the rule before us, and we'll have a little time of discussion to make sure we understand it. And
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that the court system is the appropriate branch to answer that question. I would ask our staff to make sure our legal counsel is here to answer these basic legal questions. I don't want to put the court system on the spot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Since I've not,
Representative Lynn,
since I so far failed to memorize the rules of court, can you tell me what 65 is?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg,
I don't know if everybody's got that in their packet, but we'll get a copy. That's the rule that covers injunctions. It covers three kinds of injunctions. It covers temporary injunctions, which is
pending a hearing, preliminary injunctions, which is after a hearing pending trial, and permanent injunctions. And it's the rule of procedure that covers that. We also have some statutes that are on the subject, and I think it's important, and I'd ask staff, and we'll work with you, to make sure that all the statutes are in our packet so that we can see how this will fit into the current regular court rules and statutes on this subject.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux?
So I'm thinking here that there are state permits in which if you want a temporary restraining order against the state, you'd have to go against the state. And then there are federal permits. And then you've got this category of permits where the state has primacy under, but it's basically the federal program. So you can't sue the state in federal court, am I correct, unless the state gives permission?
Nancy?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's my understanding.
Okay, so follow up. So could you get around this? This is my lawyer hat thinking right now. By not suing the state, but simply suing the industrial operation in federal court and not adding the state as a party and asking for your injunction, not of the state permit, so to speak, but of the industrial operation doing anything once they have the permit. Are you following me?
I believe so. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the sponsor may confirm or deny this, but my understanding is this is for injunctions that are filed against the industrial operation itself and not against the state as the defending party to the injunction. I think the intent was to cover lawsuits where a group or an individual wants to stop the industrial operation from proceeding, so tries to get that group itself is the defendant, is the respondent, and that group is enjoined. I had not understood that the state would be a party to those actions, and those could, of course, take place in state court or in federal court.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
Okay, so that any lawsuit which had any federal element whatsoever could probably be brought in federal court.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, and we'll probably see you on Friday.
Okay, and just to say, I won't be here on Friday, but I will be, I'm sorry to say, but I would be able to answer any questions about that civil rule now or privately other than Friday.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I inquire for
something? Representative Grimberg.
Would you be available by telephone?
I'll definitely be available.
Or somebody, Mr. Chair. I think it's important, we've got to be careful, folks, that we don't ask the court system to speak not to necessarily the right person, but also they have to be very careful because this may be an issue that ultimately comes before them. So please, but we need to have somebody available with those caveats.
Thank you. We'll give that some thought, but we'll make sure we have we'll be specifically prepared to address that. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do is let's go to Maynard Tapp.
Hello.
Yeah, Maynard, if you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. HB 47.
Maynard Tapp. I'm an individual citizen here of Anchorage in Alaska, and I'm reporting as of for myself. But I am a member. I'm also a member of the Alliance. So some of my comments will address that. The lawsuit delays that are project that delay projects that hurt the Alliance members and therefore hurt our workers that are the employees of our Alliance members. loss of wages alone are substantial, and a recent example of the cancellation of work on the project December resulted in a loss of 70 people, just from one company. And those 70 people make $50,000 to $80,000 annually, and that has a major impact on the local community by taking that money or that those earnings out of the local market. There are currently about 180 jobs at risk on another project in rural Alaska. The impact of those lost wages on the individuals as well as those communities would be staggering. If individuals wrongfully delay or restrain a project, they should be held accountable for the financial harm they caused by their action. It should be basically, I think all we're trying to be is fair so people can't just routinely and without thought throw roadblocks into the progress and the development of this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Maynard. We'll go now to... hold on a little bit, Maynard, there may be a question. Representative Greenberg.
Mr. Tapp?
Yes.
Mr. Tapp, hi, this is Max Greenberg. I would appreciate it, just for the record, if yourself and anybody else who's testifying, please let me know what your company is and what business you're in.
Okay. In this case, I'm one of the principals for Hawk Consultants, LLC. We release people to the oil companies for work that they don't have enough hires to handle.
So you provide personnel?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We're going out to Michael Youngrice, RDC. You have a comment for us.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to address you and have been listening into the prior testimony and maybe have a comment in response to a question regarding the standard for granting preliminary injunction if anybody wants me to talk about that. But let me say first that I am here to represent the Resource Development Council for Alaska on this board I sit. I'm also a partner in the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, but I am not representing that firm in my testimony here. But I also am testifying as to my own private convictions as well as the position of the RDC, which favors this legislation. The comment that I'll make, which is familiar to the lawyers, I think, on the committee, is that the power that you are legislating concerning, that is to say the injunction power that a court has, is perhaps its most powerful tool. It's really, the word I used in the past when I've testified, is an awesome power. It is an awesome power. It's the power to stop any activity from occurring in this state. And in a preliminary injunction, the court frequently only has relatively sketchy factual materials available to it to make that determination. When a large-scale enterprise, which may be in employing scores of hundreds of people and deploying millions of dollars and maybe a major economic activity in our state, it can be brought to a complete halt by the, you know, the power that the judge can impose. My experience has been that judges are kind of reluctant to impose the bonding requirement that the law allows them to impose. Perhaps because they are reluctant to make, you know, people cough up money when they feel that it's their job to stop some activity. I'm not sure why they're reluctant, but I think it is important for the legislature to make it clear that in their concern for the economic climate in the state and employment, that it is a necessary consideration for the judges to think about the impact that these decisions that they make has on the economy, on individuals, and on economic activity that they can stop. The standard for granting an injunction, according to some recent case law, which I looked up while you folks were talking to prior witnesses, State Division Elections versus Medcalf, a 2005 case, and has been cited since then, is that if the threatened injury is irreparable, meaning it's, you know, something that maybe can't be brought back, like, I don't know, chopping down a forest or filling in a lake, all that the plaintiff has to do is raise what they call a serious and substantial question, which is not frivolous or obviously without merit. So kind of the bottom line there is that a plaintiff who alleges or claims a serious enough injury does not even have to persuade the judge that that plaintiff is going to win. The judge may conclude that that plaintiff is probably going to lose, but nevertheless, it's not a frivolous case. And in that instance, the current state of the law is that a preliminary injunction has to be granted, even as again, on partial knowledge. And it seems to me that when that situation occurs, when a judge is required by the state of the law to act on partial knowledge, and even in many cases in a situation where he or she, the judge, believes that the plaintiff is not going to prevail, that they have to grant an injunction, that it's critical that the injunction only be granted with protection that protects these enterprises that are really the lifeblood, as we see it, of the state.
Thank you, Michael. We have a question from Representative Ledoux.
So, Michael, the standards are less, are they not, for the granting of a TRO, the temporary restraining order, than the preliminary injunction? Am I correct on that? There's a different standard there as to when the court's going to grant that.
Well, I don't know that you may be right, and I'm not certain about that. I know that the TRO, which by its terms can only be issued for a 10-day period, also requires security. But I can tell you that as a practical matter, the information on which a TRO is granted, I've been practicing law in the state for a while and have appeared in a number of cases in which both preliminary and temporary injunctions are at issue, is very sketchy. The information is very sketchy, frequently consisting of an affidavit or two. Rarely is there even testimony, live testimony, when these TROs are granted. And as a result, I know there are some judges who are extremely reluctant to grant temporary restraining orders, simply unless there's, you know, something terrible going on, like a child is about to be removed from the state or somebody's about to be taken off of life support. At any rate, this legislation, I believe, would apply in that situation as well, to a temporary restraining order, not to a kid leaving the state, but to an industrial permitting situation.
Follow up, Representative.
I just wanted to clarify something. I thought that when you're talking about a preliminary injunction as opposed to a temporary restraining order, that with respect to the preliminary injunction, I had thought that you had to show a likelihood of success on the merits, as opposed to simply that it's not a frivolous lawsuit. And that the standards for the temporary restraining order, I wasn't sure that you had to show a likelihood of success, that it was maybe much more of a lax standard.
Representative Ledoux, I think that once upon a time, your analysis would have been complete with respect to the preliminary injunction standard. I think that the current standard is in two parts, depending on the severity of injury that the plaintiff claims. If the plaintiff's injury is not claimed to be all that severe, if it is claimed to be less than irreparable, then indeed the plaintiff has to show a clear showing of probable success on the merits. I think that's the standard. But so in that instance, the judge would be required to really believe that the plaintiff is going to win before issuing the injunction. But there is a lessened standard where the harm that is alleged is of a greater amount. So if, you know, if you're claiming that someone is going to, you know, block your driveway and you want to prevent them from blocking your driveway, you have to show that you're probably going to win. But, you know, if what you're saying is something, you know, like that you assert is irreparable, such as, you know, the example I was giving earlier was filling a lake in or chopping down a forest, and no doubt you folks could yourselves come up with similar examples, then you do not need to show that you're likely to win. All you need to show, essentially, is that your case isn't frivolous.
Representative Greenberg?
Okay. Thank you. By the way, for those of you who don't know Mr. Jungreis, he is a very fine attorney, been in practice a long time, and has a great reputation. And thank you, Mr. Jungreis, for taking the time to testify before this committee. We're honored to have you here. With that, it looks like, do you, first, if I may ask, may I dialogue with a series of questions?
Representative Greenberg, yeah, go ahead and dialogue with.
This will just take a minute. Mr. Jungreis, the name of the case is State DNR versus Metcalf. Do you have a site on that?
Sure. It is 110 P3rd 976, and the specific citation is on page 978. That's a 2005 case.
Okay. And is there any other case you'd recommend that would be essential for this committee to have at its disposal?
You know, I'm actually looking at it from a 2010 case, which cites that earlier decision. But it just really, I mean, I'll give you the cite of the later case, but it really regurgitates or repeats the same standard. I think that's the current standard. But that later case I was looking at is called MISURA, Misura versus Misura. It's a domestic case, 244 P3rd 519. 2010 case. And before I let you speak again, I just want to say, Representative Greenberg, that you, I feel, have been one of my mentors, and if there's any merit in my current practice, it's people like you that have enabled that.
Thank you. I wasn't fishing for that, but I'll accept it.
You bet.
And we've been friends for a long time.
Can you say his number again, please? I just got the 24P. The case number?
Would you restate the question just a bit?
Can you recite the case number again, please?
Sure. The more recent case that I cited is called Misura versus Misura, mm-hmm. MISURA, mm-hmm. and that's 244 P3rd 519. It's a 2010 decision from the Alaska Supreme Court.
Mr. Jungreis, this is
Representative Greenberg, did you have something?
Yeah. I think that's a domestic case of some type.
Yes.
Okay. It sounds like this isn't as simple as maybe it used to be, that there may be evolving standards in this area that are somewhat different depending upon the extent of the injunction and the time it will last. Am I correct?
Well, I think, if I may, I think that the way I would characterize that is not as separate categories, but what the court is saying is, essentially, how serious is this injury on the one hand, and on the other hand, number one, can the defendant be protected if we grant this injury? Can we make sure that the defendant isn't isn't injured if this turns out to have been granted an error. And that's really what the purpose of today's legislation is, of course. And the other issue, on the other hand, is, all right, how good of a case has the plaintiff presented to need an injunction? So although probably the duration is an element that would be taken into account in assessing all of those factors, I'm not sure that it breaks out as a separate factor.
I understand. Since you were talking a minute ago about family law and the fact that, for example, all custody orders and orders for the division of property and injunctions are all types of injunctions. I happen to have been a family lawyer, and I know you've done some work in that area too. They talk about factors that the court should consider. And it looks to me like the language of the bill is sort of moving in that area a little. And rather than hard and fast rules, giving the court guidance and legislative priorities and intent in considering factors or issues, would that lend itself well to being used as the basis for a legislative approach here, rather than laying out hard and fast rules which may have constitutional or other problems, if we simply provided that this is a factor to be considered and the weight to be given, that sort of thing? What do you think about that?
I think you're on to something, Representative Grunberg. I guess the way I kind of visualize this is that the court has to consider the factors, but what it does with it, you know, it is for the court to determine.
That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the critical thing is the court's got to be able to show that it has looked at every one of those factors and understands that those are critical factors not to be ignored, that have to be taken into consideration, and that, you know, if there's no good reason to get away from them, they have to be utilized. But not to absolutely control. This legislation doesn't attempt to specify, you know, dollar for dollar exactly how the court must determine the issue.
Representative Ledoux, did you have a follow-up to that? Cut you off?
No, I don't. I'd like to yield if I could.
Okay, sure. Representative Ledoux?
So, Mike, when you say the court's going to have to be able to show, that makes me wonder about something. Is the denial of a TRO or a preliminary injunction, or is the amount of bond that the court requires to be posted, is that something that is appealable? And is it appealable on an expedited basis? And I see Representative Grunberg is shaking his head yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair, yes to both of those, absolutely.
Michael, did you have a response?
I think Representative Grunberg is right, and let me not shirk in my duty also of saying that Representative Ledoux is someone I've known since our mutual days as young lawyers a couple of years ago, and someone for whom I also have the highest regard in terms of her legal capability. But I think that what Representative Grunberg says is right, that certainly in every legal system that I'm aware of, in the failure to grant or the granting of injunctive relief both give rise to an immediate right to appeal.
Thank you.
If I may, through the chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah. That would be termed, actually, technically, a petition for review. Is that correct, Mr. Youngreis?
You know, I'm not certain of that. I'm not certain of that. It certainly, there's no question that you have the right to petition for review from any interlocutory order. But I think, injunctions have a special, I think, but I'm not prepared to be certain about that question. Clearly, you have the right to appeal. Whether there is a right that the court must hear your appeal, that I'm not certain of.
Mr. Chair, if we could ask Ms. Mead to answer that.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Michael, and if you would just stand by and we'll see how this goes. We may want to ask you another question. Nancy Mead, if you come back up, if you would, and respond to the question, and also I think you had something else. So.
For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I believe it would be a petition for review of the denial or grant, I suppose, of that order. So there, it's definitely reviewable by a court above the trial level, is the answer to that question.
If I may ask a couple of questions.
Representative Weaver, go ahead and dialogue.
Thank you. Ms. Mead, injunctions have to be brought in the Superior Court, not the District Court, right?
That's correct.
And if it's appealed, it would go to a single justice first, and then that could be asked for a review by the entire court, right?
I believe that's the procedure.
So it's really on an expedited basis, isn't it?
They aren't per se expedited. They aren't in the rule about which proceedings are automatically expedited. Petitions for review can be handled faster, of course, than an appeal of a full case. Yes.
Thank you.
I thought petitions for review, whether a court heard a petition for review or not, was a discretionary thing. Am I correct or incorrect about that?
It is correct. A petition for review is discretionary. That's
so
right.
They have the right to buy on it, but that doesn't necessarily mean the court's going to do anything about it.
That's right.
Or even, I mean, it could, as opposed to affirming it or denying it, it might just simply stay out there in limbo.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Ledoux.
Thank you.
Representative Greenberg?
Sure. I think if that is that would be the case, that unless and until the court issued a superseding order on appeal, that the trial court's original order would remain in effect. Ms. Mead, is that correct?
That's right.
And then I saw you talking with the sponsor, Nancy, and did you have anything else that you want to...
Yes, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to go on the record for a second time on this. There is a wording that I talked to the sponsor in his office about that I wanted to just ask the committee to consider to the CS, and that would be on line 11, the sentence in the bill that says the court shall consider the amount of wages and benefits for employees and payments to contractors and subcontractors. It might be beneficial to have wording in there that says upon the request of any party and when that party presents credible evidence. Ooh. So something that says that if, for example, the industrial operation did not want to disclose records about its wages or its contracts or subcontractors, the court wouldn't have any evidence to consider. So some sort of language that said when there was evidence and when the party wanted it, the court has to consider that, because otherwise the court wouldn't have the means or information to consider those factors. And that was something that the sponsor's office was receptive towards, and therefore I just wanted to bring it to your attention.
Well, on that, we can, if you have a question on the spine, but we'll come back and the sponsor on Friday with language for discussion on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask Ms. Mead if you could make sure that either formally or informally some exact language is presented to anybody here.
I will do that. Thank you.
Outstanding. Yeah, good.
Seeing nothing else right now, thank you.
Thank you.
What we're going to do now is go to Mike Prox. By the way, Mike, I know somebody else by that name, and he once said Prax or Prox, whatever you want. And I was wondering, this is your chance. You can put it on the record for all to hear. Is it Prox or Prax? Mike?
we like, or I guess, like to call it prox, but even my wife calls it prax, so I respond either one.
Thanks for taking time to call in. Please, your testimony.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Prox, and I am just representing myself, and mostly I came here to listen today. And I too, want to offer a compliment of the Judiciary Committee. I appreciate the way that the viewpoint of the minority is definitely considered and taken in by the committee. I really appreciate the way that's run. I guess I have...
I can't help but jump in, Mike, and tell you that I really appreciate the hard work and the diligence of the staff I have. Your son is doing a great job.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. I have two concerns, I guess. I think that the change to make that something the courts shall consider rather than just do, I think that was needed. So that's a good thing. And this legislation, I think, is definitely needed because there does seem to be the injunctions do seem to be granted too easily, and but it would be interesting. I just, as I was listening, I thought that we should know how often essentially injunctions are overturned. I think that would be good for the committee to know. But the specific situation that I was somewhat familiar with or followed was this Healy Clean Coal, and I don't know that this would have applied to it, but tens of millions of dollars a year to the consumers, the members of Golden Valley were lost. Now that wouldn't be considered, but these injunctions really do have a substantial impact. That case eventually went through, but it appeared to me from reading the court decisions or the actually, it didn't even get to the court, I guess, at that time, so it wouldn't apply, but that the objections to Healy Clean Coal were without merit from the start, and the injunction, it appeared that the strategy was to just run the cost up so that Golden Valley would give up on the project, regardless of the merits of the case. And I think that happens quite often. I think that that's a strategy that attorneys apply sometimes. So this is needed. This is needed to maintain equity, which should be a primary goal, and that's what the committee should focus on. Now, with that in mind, I hadn't given thought to Section D, that it's not required, that you're not going to require it under cases where the state is acting with primacy over federal regulations. I would encourage you to contact the EPA or somebody in the federal government and get their opinion directly if you can, because my concern is that the state agencies often are overly conservative in their interpretations of those laws and too concerned, therefore, about losing primacy. And I'm not sure that the EPA and the Department of Natural Resources would be objecting to this to the degree that they would, what is the right word, withdraw primacy or whatever I'm trying to get at there. So I think it would be a good idea for you to talk directly to them if you can and just get another point of view. I think that the state agencies are overly concerned about this myself, and that we shouldn't have something that applies differently depending on the type of permit that somebody is operating under. And I thought that Mr. Youngwright's comments about issuing injunctions without necessarily the probability of winning in the end was very relevant. The fact that somebody has issued a court action by itself discourages a company from moving forward. And it just doesn't seem to me to have that there's any harm in trying to maintain equity in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. And I really identify with your remarks on being overly cautious on what the federal program is, what they want. That's one we have to keep on top of all time. Thank you. Any questions for Mike? Representative Grimberg?
Yes. Mr. Prox, thank you for the comments, the kind comments, and I think your points are well taken. One of the problems, and I think this is something that on this committee we might consider way beyond this bill, is the difficulty and high cost of litigation and how one party or another, particularly the party with the deeper pocket, can make it very difficult for the other party to be heard. And this is everything from family law on down to big corporations, and nothing against rich people, but that I think that if we seek equity, that we might, as a committee, think about what we can do to make sure that the law isn't misused.
Do you have a question for Mike, Representative Grimberg?
That was a soliloquy, as Hamlet.
And I caught you at it, that's why.
I mean, if it was just, I could always say, don't you agree, but that's... Thank you, Mike, I appreciate it.
This is a valid point, and I appreciate you raising it, and it's certainly one we have to keep in perspective. I want to go back to Mike Youngrice. I did not mean to cut you off in any way, shape, or form. I thought that you were done, but Representative Grimberg suggested you may not have been.
Those were also the remarks that I had prepared. I'm obviously interested in responding to any questions that you had for me, and I think that the bottom line that I was presenting is pretty clear, which is that the Resource Development Council, and for that matter, Mike Youngrice, who's been practicing law for a while, believe that something on this order is really critical in order to ensure that the projects that are the lifeblood of this state are protected from this particular kind of disruption.
I just, as the chair, I want to thank you on behalf of the committee for you taking time to help us get that done. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Rogers, are you online? From Anchorage?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I put myself on the record, I just want to confirm that you can hear me.
I can hear you loud and clear. Go ahead and identify yourself, and we'll respond.
Thank you very much, sir. For the record, my name is Andrew Rogers. I am the Deputy Director of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And the Alaska State Chamber is a member organization made up of companies across the state. And this is an evergreen issue for us. We do have something substantive to add to the discussion. It's not legalese or ruling's judgments on the legal issues, but it is the support of the business community behind passing this. It's been a long time issue for us, providing support for it, I believe, was HB 168 several years ago. Last year it was one of our positions, and that support continues today. And I think it's worth paying attention to when you have everything from tourism and companies and home to large companies and Ketchikan that come together and agree on an issue. We have lots of positions and priorities, but when one of them like this gets universal support from across the state and across a broad cross-section of industries, it carries a bit of weight. And we will continue to support the core concepts of this legislation as it stands now. We did get a copy of the, I believe it's a working copy of the bill as it currently stands, and we'll be watching to see the final form of the CS that comes out. But did want to go on record on behalf of Alaska's businesses as encouraging the committee to pass this legislation out of committee, and also if I could ask for your support for whatever final form the legislation takes on the floor.
Thank you very much, Andy. I don't see any questions at this time. So, just kind of take inventory of where we're at. We're going to leave public testimony open. Is there anybody in the room that I've missed that I didn't see anyone else? And nobody else online, I believe, except those from Department of Law and the AG's office to answer questions if we have them. But anyway, we're going to leave public testimony open. We'll try to revisit this on Friday. And there have been some suggestions of, testimony to be available. I'm sure the sponsor has picked up on that. Representative Feige, did you have any parting thoughts or, anything else from the committee? Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for handling it like this. I would hope that since this is a very important area, and there are lots of nuances to it, that we can have on Friday a significant amount of time for the bill, and so that the members starting out, so that the members can hear the latest legal theories on injunctions, because there's a body of law on that, and it's a lot changed since I went to law school and read the AJ Industries case in the 1960s. And I think we all need to be brought up to date on that so we can see the background against which this law is presented, this bill.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. And the fact that Nancy won't be there on Friday is going to present some problem, but I'm sure she can suggest somebody to Eric. So that's great. And I'd love to learn that.
And the
also,
Department of Law and our legal counsel, I don't often suggest this, but it might be, and we can think about this, that between us all, the lawyers around, there may be some law professor we would like to have on the phone to talk about this. Sometimes when we have a Uniform Act, you'll remember, to present the Uniform Act, usually drafted by a law professor, but on something like this, we haven't had somebody like that, and it may be that it'd be worth seeing if we could get somebody to let us know.
Representative Grunberg, we'll let Nancy and Representative Feige come up with a suggestion for us and let them handle it the way they will for the Friday meeting. And hopefully, my intent is that, with all the questions that are out there and everything, that we'll have an opportunity to vote on this bill on Friday. So, okay.
If we have that the time,
Yeah. Seeing nothing else, we're going to gavel out 25 minutes early. Before I do, what we have planned for Wednesday is HB 218. It has to do with penalty related to assault on a correction employee. And we have HB 255 coming up. That's on drones, unmanned aircraft. That'll be an interesting event. And then Friday will be cleanup. So with that, we're going to gavel out.